Good afternoon. Welcome to this session on debugging. You know, I love that I haven't been able to scare you away with my warning. It's great to see that so many of you have remained. I've been doing this talk for about 15 kilograms. I used to gain a lot of weight in the past, so if you've seen me earlier, then I used to be a little bit slim. I'm now seeing these photos from people who put them on Twitter, and I say, you know, I really have to lose a little bit of weight. So I might do this for another few kilos this session, but maybe the other way around in this case. I also really appreciate that you have chosen this session instead of following the royal wedding, which is also very nice because this might be, I don't know which one is more impressive. The thing is, my wife, she's following the wedding and she's giving constant updates on Facebook, and all her friends do the same thing, so it's quite interesting. So I'm following this only offline. Okay, I've decided against doing a live feed here because this would have been possible, but I need the screen space. So this session is about debugging. It's about some of the well-hidden debugging features of Visual Studio. If you've been around in the .NET space for quite a while, you might recognize, especially at the beginning, you might recognize a few of those things. But I'd like to point them out nevertheless so that you can see even as some kind of a reminder of what's possible in Visual Studio. Now, there are, of course, a number of things which might be very new to you. But there are a number of things in Visual Studio 2010 which are new in terms of debugging. And let's get started. So the thing is, I have only one slide, one PowerPoint slide, which is this one, which just, this is just something, kind of a red line throughout this talk so that I can remember what I wanted to show you. The problem is I can't debug on PowerPoint because code on PowerPoint doesn't fail. So I need to do this in Visual Studio. I can promise I've written pages upon pages of code on PowerPoint. It never failed. Okay, so let's go into Visual Studio. And in Visual Studio, just before going into this application, I'm going to tell you what this app actually is. It is maybe the world's worst application. It's a really buggy application. Now, you can download this at my weblog. If you Google for Ingo Rammer, you'll get to my weblog, and then you'll be able to download this right at the first hit, usually. Now, you know, from a number of sessions, you might know best practice applications. That's not. That's the worst practice application. So we have to be clear about this. You shouldn't copy-paste anything you see in this app to your code. It really wouldn't work. I mean, you could do this, right, if you want to challenge your coworkers. I'm going to show you a few things during this talk, how you can have fun with coworkers. And so, yeah. But don't tell them that I told you to do this, right? And especially don't tell your manager. They might not send you to a conference like this if they find out that I'm causing trouble here. Okay, so we have this application. Now, I use this for different debugging sessions as well. So in this case, I'm only using a small subset of the application, but I just want to tell you what you're seeing here. And behind all of these buttons, there are some kinds of bugs hidden. Okay, but we won't need too many of those bugs today because it's more about what Visual Studio can do for you. Now let's get this started. And we'll start very easy. We'll start with a breakpoint. And, well, not with a regular breakpoint. I assume that everybody knows what a regular breakpoint is. So let me check this. Who knows what a breakpoint is? Who doesn't? Ah, that's perfect. You're in the right session. I've had this once where I asked a question and there were three hands up who didn't know what a breakpoint was. And I was starting to wonder, so why exactly are you in an advanced debugging session if you don't know what a breakpoint is? But okay, everybody here is in the right session. That's perfect. No marketing people there. That's great. You have left your boss at home so we can debug. Okay, now everybody knows what a breakpoint is, so we can remove this one again. Whenever we talk about debugging or advanced debugging, there is one option which is critical, and I'll just open this one. It's in Tools Options, of course, Debugging, and you have a number of options, but the one I'd like to talk about right now is the Enable Just My Code, because this changes everything in Visual Studio Debugging. By default, it's checked, which means that a lot of debugging features only work on your code, which most of the time is exactly what you want. So, you know, for example, if Enable Just My Code is checked, and if you go to Tools Options, if you go to Debug Exceptions, that you get this dialogue to in which you can select how you want to break on certain exceptions. You get different options. You can check to break only on thrown and check to break only on user unhandled. But that's, of course, quite well known, I assume. Now, if enable just my code is checked, and if you, even if you check thrown here, it will only break on your thrown exceptions. Now, I'm going to remove this option. That's why I've mentioned this. When I'm removing this option, and I'm unchecking enable just my code because I want to break in somebody else's code, for example, then this dialog changes. That's the obvious one, debug exceptions. And you now only have thrown because the system doesn't know anymore if you handle the code or somebody else handled the exception, etc. So it will just warn you. If you check this, your application will break on various points and you will see exceptions pop up which you've never seen before. And some of them are first chance exceptions. You can just step over them. But that's important to realize. You will see a lot more exceptions now that when you enable or disable this or when you change this mode. Okay. So we don't need to break on exceptions here, but what I wanted to show you is how to create breakpoints on arbitrary pieces of code. You can use the new breakpoint dialog, which is Control B by default in the default key binding, or which could be found under debug. Is it debug new breakpoint break at function? That's the one. Now we normally don't do this. We normally take, if you set a breakpoint, you go to the line, you simply click here or you hit F9 or something like this. But Control B is a lot more powerful. Control B allows you to set a breakpoint in any function. And interestingly enough, that's not just your function, but any function. So when would you need this? Well, let's just assume that you are watching, you're looking at some framework code, not your code, but somebody else's code. Maybe you're looking at some third-party components code. And you figure out, you know, that it feels that something is happening somewhere down the line. Something is not right. You're maybe looking at the code in Reflector. In Reflector, you're looking at the decompiled code and you figure out, you know, I'd like to break there. And the easiest way is to use, I just need to check because it seems that there's something wrong with my microphone, is it? No. Okay. Because I hear a pop noise from time to time. Okay, but if it's okay for you, it's definitely okay for me. Now, you can break at any method. You can qualify it using namespace.classname.method, or you just say break on write line. If you use IntelliSense, then it will only check public code and your code, so I'm not checking this one. I'm just setting a breakpoint on write line. You don't see the breakpoint happening here in this code because it's not set on this line. The breakpoint is actually set at the first line inside of the write line method. So if I go to the breakpoint dialog, you'll see that this is a breakpoint group. There is no documentation for this feature in Visual Studio. It's just there. That's a group which will be resolved dynamically at runtime. So if you run the application, and it breaks. It now says, yeah, okay, I've broken somewhere where there is no source code available. Of course, because I'm breaking inside of some write line method. But what we can do is we can, of course, look at the call stack. And then we see, okay, the breakpoint was hit in write line. And I could step back to my main method. And let's just do this and I see, okay, I'm obviously breaking somewhere underneath this write line method. That's a fantastic feature. Because it's very easy. It's Control B. You enter the method name. You set the breakpoint. No harm. If you now look at the breakpoints window, you can expand this tree view item, and you'll see all the breakpoints which have been created behind the scenes. This means a few things. These breakpoints are evaluated at runtime. So whenever you start your application, it is going to slow the start process down quite a bit, actually. You might have to wait for 5 seconds before your application starts, because whenever a DLL is loaded in your target process, Visual Studio will examine all the types, all the classes in this DLL, will examine all the methods and try to find out if it matches your definition for a breakpoint. This means you shouldn't set, well, of course, you should be careful. You should not forget to remove them again after debugging, because I sometimes forget to remove them, and then it really takes a long time for every startup. And you should never set it on toString. Okay. And we remove this one. Because really, it would set this, you know, you would have quite a whole number, a whole lot of breakpoints. I don't even know if Visual Studio would really like this. Okay, I'm not going to try this now. So this is a breakpoint. Now what else can you do with a breakpoint? There are a number of things you can do to breakpoints, which you might need from time to time. Some of them have been well thought out, but not well executed. So there are other options which you can choose instead. And if you right-click a breakpoint, I'm sure most of you have seen this. You have a number of properties you can set for this breakpoint. And so you have location. Location is something which you hardly ever use this dialog for, because this is just the location of the breakpoint. I mean, we are in source code anyway, so you're exactly on the line. This is your location. A condition is more interesting. I'm going to talk about conditions in a second. That's where you can say, you know what, I want this breakpoint to only trigger if condition X is true. So you can examine your application at the same time. Hit count is easy. You only hit the breakpoint if, let's say, if it's been hit 10 times and you only want to stop the 10th time. Filter is something I have never used in practice. It allows you to filter a breakpoint to a certain thread or to a certain process if you debug multiple processes. When hit is interesting, that's one of the most underused features of a breakpoint. And then you can define a label. You can give it a name now so that you can export them and re-import them later on. OK, but let's look at condition first. Now, I'm going to show you a piece of code. And that's the one. And in here, I'm calculating some values. Let me just scroll this up so that it's easier to read. OK. So what I'm doing here is this is just a loop. I'm just looping for 0 to some random number. And I'll do some calculations. And let's just assume that you are in your debugging process. You figure out that there is something happening at this point, but it's not, you know, it's on, I don't know, the second to last element. So you can't set a breakpoint because this would mean jumping over maybe 10,000 elements, but you only want to stop on the second to last. That's the idea behind a conditional breakpoint. So let me just run this code with a regular breakpoint first so that you see the speed of execution here. I just run this, and I'm here. I hit I'm hitting F5 now. And it completes immediately. So that's just to show you that this calculation does not really take a lot of time, because it's going to be interesting as soon as we put in a conditional breakpoint here. I'll add the breakpoint. I right-click on it. I click on condition. Condition allows you to specify a C# expression in here. And this expression will be evaluated behind the scenes. And this it looks like a text box, but it even gives you IntelliSense. So basically what I want to do is I want to break if I equals number of elements, there should be a number of elements minus 2. This would be my condition. And I want to break on this condition. Now, this seems like a good idea, because that's exactly what this feature has been meant for. But it comes with a certain problem. And long calculation. So I'm in here. I hit F5 now. And it's taking a while. So the thing is, this conditional breakpoint is actually triggering a real breakpoint behind the scenes for every iteration. It stops the process, goes to Visual Studio. Visual Studio looks at the condition, finds out which values it needs to transfer from my target process into the Visual Studio process, then runs the condition and figures out if it should really stop or not. So as you've seen, this is taking a while. Right now, we only have 1,900 elements. But if you have 10,000 or 100,000 elements, that's massively slowing down your debugging process. This is useful if you cannot recompile your source code right now, if you're attaching to a running application, for example. If I can recompile the application, I don't use breakpoints like these. Instead, I use a statement similar to the following one. Let's say if I put the condition directly in the target code, if I equals number of element minus 2, debugger.break. Debugger is in system.diagnostics. And you can use this to break into the debugger. Now, you have to be extremely and very and absolutely careful about if you're using this. So first, I'll run the code again, F5. Run the calculation. I'll hit F5 again. And you can see it immediately reaches this point. No more waiting for us. It's a dynamic breakpoint, which I can adapt to my application. So the problem with this code is that you should never forget to remove it. Well, you're laughing, but you don't actually yet know what's happening when you forget to remove it. Now, the thing is, let's just assume that you are shipping this code, and Your customer runs this code on their machine, and usually they are not very happy because the problem is your application simply crashes because it triggers a just-in-time debugging dialog. If I would have, so I can't click debug here because I'm running this on a development machine. If you do this on the runtime machine, you get Windows error reporting. Do you want to upload to Microsoft? And that's it. Okay. So you have to remove this. That's number one. Or, and that's what I usually do, is if debugger is attached, debugger break. Actually, you should never write the debugger.break statement without guarding it with the debugger.isattached before. Unless you really want it to explicitly fire up this debug dialog so that you can attach to this process. Okay, but that's a good thing, and it's an easy thing which you can use to break into your code without using a conditional breakpoint, oops, which usually is too slow. Okay, and then there is the when hit option. What to do when this breakpoint is hit? And let's go there, when hit. And there are a few things you could do. By default, this is unchecked. So by default, your application stops, of course, and we are going into Visual Studio as a debugger. However, we could actually print a message, and the default message is function name thread name, or thread ID thread name, and you just get a message into your console output in Visual Studio. And that's quite interesting, because I don't know how often I've looked at code, and I said I need to figure out in which sequence a number of events are triggered, for example. And that's easy. You can just set these breakpoints, configure them to be trace points. That's what we call a trace point. And if you configure them to be trace point, you'll just get the output without you having to go through your program and adding console.writeline statements over and over throughout your application. It's very easy. You just check this. And then you can, at the bottom of this, you can say continue execution. Do you want to immediately continue execution after this breakpoint has been triggered? Or you can run a macro. That's, of course, that's power, that's pure power, because then you can trigger one breakpoint which, I don't know, reconfigures other breakpoints, for example, to work through very very interesting or very hard to debug scenarios. When you say, okay, I need condition X for 5 times before I can enable this breakpoint, etc. Okay, there are a number of sample macros in Visual Studio which use this debugger statement. But now we'll remove this one again. Okay, so these were the more important things about breakpoints. It's really, you know, you sometimes need them, or need these features, and then it's good to know that they exist. The next thing I'd like to show you is something very different. It's not about breakpoints, it's about how objects look like in the debugger. So I've created a class called Customer, which mimics the usual data class you'll see in a lot of different projects. So I have a property name here, property first name. They are backed by local variables. And I have a property address of type address, which has a property city and street. And I'm just instantiating a customer of this type. And I'll fill it. So we just say first name is John, name is Doe, customer.address is a new address, and city is Den Haag, and customer address street is demo street. Okay, so we do something like this. And do you write Den Haag like this, or is this only the Germanish version of Den Haag? Is this correct? Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. I just wanted to make sure that I'm not insulting anyone by not knowing how this city is actually written. In German, it's written like this. So, and I'm from Austria, but moved to Germany quite a while ago, and so I'm way too used to this now. Okay. So let's run this. And let's look at the locals window and expand this. And, of course, that's exactly what you would have expected, right? We're doing this on a day-by-day basis. Nothing is magic here. However, it's a bit problematic. And it's problematic because, let me just remove this a bit. It's problematic because it gives me actually not enough information. It could give me more information. Just assume that we have a list of customer objects and we need to find one customer out of this list. Let's say you have 100 in an array. I need to expand all of them to look at the first name and the last name properties. And I see this actually quite often in a lot of different projects. In maybe 95% of projects or more, they would just go ahead and click and click and click. And I see developer doing this when I'm watching them. Click, click, click to find the one they're looking for. There's no reason to do this. There's an easy-to-use attribute which you can put on your customer to change the way it's displayed in the debugger. So one of them would be debugger display. All these attributes are in the system diagnostics namespace. And in debugger display, you can specify a string, a pattern, which is used to display a certain object, this one-line summary. So I could say, OK, I want to see first name, last name, first name, name in address.city. You can call methods there. You can access properties, whatever you want. If anything fails, let's say if this would throw an exception, you would just see that this part, it tells you that, OK, it has thrown an exception, but nothing breaks or anything. It's very easy, just one line of attribute if code. And if I run this now, I get an immediate information about who I'm looking at. And that's the important thing. If I'm looking at a list of these now, I can immediately see what I'm looking at. Really, it's just this one attribute. Clicking and opening 10 items in a list is taking longer than writing this attribute. OK, there are more attributes like these. There is one which allows you to hide internals, for example. You can say, you know what, I don't want to see the privates. I want the user of my class to only see the public properties, because they don't need to see my implementation details. So there is another attribute called debugger browsable. And you pass in a debugger browsable state. And this state could be never. This means this property is never visible in the debugger. So I can set this on all my privates. I can set this on these privates. And I can run my code. And if we expand it now, we'll only see the publicly visible version of this code. So you only see public properties. If you don't want this, there is an option in tools options debugging, which is here and is called show raw structure of objects in variable windows. And that's exactly what this feature does. It disables this customization again and enables the raw view again. Because let's say if you develop a class library for other developers in your company, you might want to see your internals. It's just that as soon as you're ready, everybody else doesn't have to see your internals if you don't need this. OK. What else can you do? Well, you can do interesting things. You can say, you know what? In the object-oriented way, I've split out the address from the customer. But in the debugger, I'd like to view them at the same level of hierarchy for whatever reason. I'm not saying that this is good or bad. I'm just saying that this is possible. It could be quite confusing. Because what you could do is you could go to your address property and use another debugger browsable attribute with the debugger browsable state root hidden. This just means that, you know, the root object is hidden and all the properties will just be transferred to the parent object in the debugger. So if we run this, I can expand the customer and see everything on the same level. Is this good or bad? Well, you know, if you have a really, really good reason to do this, it might make sense. It might, however, confuse the user of your class, because they will be looking for a street property on the customer, which doesn't exist. So you can confuse. Yes, please. Is there a way to include address to also include it at the same time, or? Ah, okay. You call to change the name here. Okay. This would be interesting, but unfortunately it's not possible by default, but there is a feature which allows you to do exactly this. And that's one of the most interesting features in when debugging. There is a concept of a debugger type proxy. And the debugger type proxy is pure magic. It basically gives you a second object which stands in as your first one. Whenever you view an object of type X in your debugger, you're seeing an object of type Y instead. And that's very easy to realize this. You have a public class customer proxy, which doesn't need any special interfaces. So it just needs to have one constructor, which takes an instance of the type you are proxying for. And we'll just store this locally in my class. And then you can create different properties. So I could say public string address city and get return customer address city. And you can do, well, that's the nice use case, and you can do things like simply confusing your coworkers. Public string nursed fame instead of first name. You know, it might take somebody a while to realize that they're actually seeing something which they can't be seeing. That's pretty interesting. The brain works in this way that it filters out things which can't be, but at some point in time you're seeing this and you're like, whoa, what's that? Customer.firstname. And so let's try this one. And now, of course, by default, nothing happens because I need to associate those two types. I need to tell one type that it has to be a proxy for another type. So I go to my customer, and so that there are a number of options how to associate them. There is the obvious option. You can say, it's debugger type proxy, type of customer proxy. So you go to your target class and tell it, you know, my proxy is this one. Unfortunately not. So what's happening is, so do you want this attribute to be invisible? That's absolutely possible. And I'm going to show you in a second. Because this... we are understanding each other. I can see this. So the problem is there is always the raw view here. Right? And you cannot turn this off. This used to be possible to turn this off, but for whatever reason... And I don't know why it's not possible anymore. So even if you did not check show raw view of objects, this is always visible. But it's still fun for the first time you try this on some new hire. It's especially fun if your class has, let's say, 50 properties, because this one will only show up at the end. And nobody's browsing to the end. Okay, there's a question. What would happen in debugger display? It would tell you here, cannot be evaluated. If this would cause an exception, it would tell you, can't be evaluated. Nothing would break. Yep?
Does the compiler automatically remove all this stuff for production?
Perfect question. Does the compiler remove this stuff for production? And this question is the same one as the answer at least is similar to the one where, can I put this attribute somewhere else? Because that's what most people actually do. You don't do it like this, but what you normally do is, well, of course, you could, on one hand, you could put this into an if-def, right? You could say, if debug, and only if debug do this. That's fine. That's something which would be possible. Then it's removed in release mode. And what you also can do is you can put all this debugger code, and there is another type I'm going to show you which allows you to customize this. You put them into a separate assembly. And in this separate assembly, you put an attribute similar to this one. You take the same attribute. Now it's not debugger visualizer. That's something I'm going to show you in a second. But you take debugger type proxy, the attribute, and you put it not on a class, but you put it on assembly level. By just creating an empty C# file in your other DLL, adding this one, and you pass in the type of your debugger, of your proxy, and the target type. And you can define your proxy in a separate assembly as well. So you have both of them separate, your real code and your debugging code. And then you compile this additional DLL, go to the machine of your new hire, and look for the... There's in my document somewhere, and in my documents you have a Visual Studio subdirectory, and in Visual Studio there is a visualizer subdirectory, or there could be one. And if you drop the DLL in there, you don't have to register it. You don't even have to restart Visual Studio. You just drop it in there. It will be read immediately. And these visualizers and these proxies will be active right from this point on. You delete it again, they are gone. You are even more evil than I thought. That's interesting. I did the same session yesterday or the day before in Belgium, and they were like, we would never do this. That's interesting. Okay. Excuse me? Is it possible to generate this file? You could generate them using, let's say, TT templates, T4 templates directly in your solution. Yeah. Absolutely, because you just need to look at the metadata and then you could generate those. So you could have a lot of fun if necessary. The next thing you can do in a similar way is not just a proxy, but you could use a debugger visualizer. That's the next concept in Visual Studio. This is a little bit different. That's a class which derives from a certain base type. So it's the customer visualizer, for example, and this derives from a dialogue debugger visualizer. And dialogue debugger visualizer gives you one method which you have to implement. And that's the method show. And in method show, you get a Windows service and an object provider. And by the way, there is one thing which I nearly forgot to mention. To make this work, the assembly which contains these proxies and the debugger has to reference one additional DLL. And this DLL is Microsoft Visual Studio Debugger Visualizers, if you want to use these capabilities. This doesn't have to be your production code because you can split the assemblies. But the assembly which contains the visualizers and the proxies has to reference this. And you find this and copy this over and make it bigger. You'll find this somewhere in your Visual Studio directory. It's in Visual Studio directory common 7 IDE reference assemblies version of the framework, and then you find your DLL. This version is Visual Studio version specific, so you might have a separate visualizer DLL compiled once for Studio 2008, once for 2010. Okay, but as soon as you reference this, you get a few features, for example, the type proxying and the visualizing. You don't need this just for debugger display. Debugger display is something you can always use. Okay, but for the visualizers. Now, a visualizer allows you to manipulate the object in a different way. Let's just restart our application once more. If we expand this and zoom in here, then you'll see that you have these magnifying glasses here. And these magnifying glasses are debugger visualizers. And we can create our own, just like the string one. When I click here, the string is opened in a separate window, and I can close this again. And now we'll do the same for the customer. I'm just going to fake my way. I'm not going to write a form here to actually display the customer, but that's what you could do. And I'd have to access my customer, cast equals object provider, which is one of those parameters, dot get object. This would be the object provider. And then you could show a form. This is still Windows Forms code. So you do something like form1 FRM equals new form. Equals new form. And you then say, you'd not say, that's important, not FRM.show. This wouldn't work because you have to show it inside of Visual Studio context. You have to show it inside of their context. That's what this Windows service is for. You would instead call Windows service show dialog FRM. That's what you would do. And then you show it inside of Visual Studio. And instead, I can't do this here. It would take too long. So what I'm doing is I'm showing a message box instead. Message box show here comes your dialog. Normally, your dialog would come here. In your dialog, you'd allow the user to change this property. So we change the name to demo customer number 2. And the first name to Martin. And then you hand this new object back to Visual Studio. So you would say object provider replace object customer. The important thing here is that this object has to be serializable. So because you're running in a separate process, you're running on one hand Visual Studio and the other hand on your target process. That's why you can't simply change a property, and that's why you have to call replace object to send it back, the serialized one, into your target process. Okay, but let's run this. And, I need to put my attribute on customer, of course. And this attribute is similar. It's debugger visualizer, type of customer visualizer. And we'll start this one, run it. And then we'll get the exclamation mark, the magnifying glass here as well. And if I click it, my dialog comes. You can imagine this is now a dialog having a text box or two text boxes. I click OK, and it immediately changes my customer here. So I can change this information there using my custom dialog. If you have more complex data structures in your application, This allows the developer who is debugging your app to visualize them and maybe change them. That's the idea behind this. Okay. And let's switch back to my slide deck so that I know what I wanted to show you. Okay. There is an interesting feature there are two interesting features to do multi-threaded debugging with Visual Studio, which are extremely well hidden. And because they are disabled by default. The first one is disabled by default. So I just need to find the correct form. Yeah, that's the one. And those two forms, when I check the checkbox here, if you download this application, then each module will be started in its own thread. And what we are simulating here is two different forms which want to work with the same lock, or two different threads which want to work with the same lock. And, you know, blue means I have the lock, red means I want the lock. And this one keeps it for 60 seconds. So I'll open another one. So we have this situation. You have one thread which obviously blocks something and two threads which would like whatever is blocked here. So how would it normally work? Well, first let me stop this application. There is a debugging window which is debug Windows threads. So that's step number one. We have to visualize the threads. And here we are. These are our threads. I just need to clean this up a bit. Now, in Visual Studio 2010, this window is a little bit more powerful than in 2008. In 2010, you can expand the call stacks for each thread, so you don't have to click on the thread to see a call stack. You can immediately see the call stacks for all your threads to get some kind of overview, because the problem is in multi-threaded debugging, you usually don't know exactly what's happening, so you need to get first some kind of overview to see, whoa, where is my application at, what's actually happening. And then you can look for one of your threads right now. And yep, we found the right one. It's a thread.sleep, of course, but let's just assume that we've, by chance, found another one. And then the only thing you normally see is, when you click the code, is you see your thread is at this position. And there is a feature in Visual Studio which is hidden, and I have no idea why this, or is disabled by default, and I have no idea why. And this is this one. Two wavy lines and a plus means, is that the international standard symbol for show me where the other threads are. Because now you can see it. That's the interesting thing. I disable this again. As soon as I enable it in my code, I see where the other threads are in my code. That's fantastic. I would have never disabled this by default. But okay. And not only can you see it, but by gray, graying just means there is another thread running this line. You also get the squiggly lines here. You can right-click the squigglies and switch to, because some other thread is living there. So you can easily switch to this other thread and view the world from this point of view. So we switch to this one. And then we see, of course, yep, we are here and others are here. And you see all the others. So you can right-click again. And now we have two of them sitting here. Now you can do interesting things like you can flag them. So I can right-click on one of them, I can say flag, and I click on one. What's happening is up here in the threads window, this thread is now flagged. This is just a means to allow you to find this thread. Well, because just assume that we have not three workers here, but we have 50, because this is a web application. And then this will flag the correct thread you're looking at. And then there are interesting features, and It took myself quite a long time to actually realize that they exist. Quite often, when you debug multi-threaded applications, you find out the thread you're currently interested in, and you'd like to stop all the others, because you know there might be a background thread doing a polling on a message queue or something, and you just want to ignore the message queuing for now. You can Control-A, or you can multi-select them in whatever way. You can right-click, and then you have a few options, and one of them is freeze. You can freeze a group or individual threads. So what I'm doing now is I'm freezing all of them. Then they will be paused. You can't freeze this one because it has ended already. It's only a historical view. And then you can right-click one and you can say thaw. You want to wake this one up again. And that's how you can allow one thread to continue running while stopping all the others. And that's very, very easy, actually. And so I could say thaw and continue this one. In my case, I just continue all of them. Now, this has been pretty much available with Studio 28 as well. There are two more features, or actually one right now, which is new with 2010, and this is in debug Windows parallel stacks. This has been introduced with the parallel framework, with the tasks and threading framework, and with TPL, task parallel library. But actually, it's also very valuable if you don't use the TPL at all, but if you do multi-threaded debugging. Parallel stacks, and we need to look into this a bit, because that's not immediately obvious how this works, is, so what I'll do is, I have way too little space here. Okay, let's try to move this somewhere, because I need to see the source code as well. Okay, let's try it this way. I just zoom out, and then we'll talk about this, and then we'll zoom in. Can you read this? Absolutely. Okay, so what you're seeing here is the structure of your application. You see that, you know what, there are a number of threads which have a certain stack frame. What this tool does is it looks at threads which have the same stack frames, and it then diverts these when they see alternation in the stack frame. So for example, here, let me zoom in at the very bottom. What this tells us is there are 6 threads which have been started with these 5 stack frames. Of course, they are the standard stack frames when you start a managed code thread. And then let's go upwards, and I need to find the right one. I think, is this our right one? Yeah. And then we have a number of threads which have been started using this stack frame. And you know that somebody clicked that button, get lock and work, and called the method test lock. And then out of these 3 different threads which share the same stack frame, we have 1 thread which has a thread.sleep in its stack frame and 2 threads which wait for something. And that's now pretty nice, because in a 3-thread application, that's not really that powerful. But if you view this on a 50-thread server-side application, the view you're getting now is pretty massive. Okay, and this is not just... And that's interactive, so you can click on it and it will position yourself in the code. So that's the problem with the whole screen space here, because you can click it and say, okay, I want to see this position in my code, etc. So that's pretty nice. That's called parallel stacks. Okay, what else do we have? Sometimes you need to debug into foreign assemblies. So there is... As you've seen, there's a control B where you can set a breakpoint in whatever arbitrary method in whatever assembly you want. There is also one ability or one option. And there was a time when everybody knew that this existed, and then Microsoft stopped talking about this. It's an option debugging general, and it's called enable.NET Framework source stepping. And if you enable this, then you can F11 into some parts of the .NET framework. And you can set breakpoints in the .NET framework. It will download source code from Microsoft so that you can view the source code and debug into it. If that's not enough, because you maybe have a problem in some third-party code which is not from Microsoft, but for which you also don't have source code, then you know, well, of course, you know Reflektor. I assume that everybody knows Reflektor. Reflektor? Aha. Who of you hated the decision of Redgate that they wanted to make it commercial? You were right, and they have reverted this decision 3 days ago. It's now a free tool again. But only version 6.8. So the future versions will be commercial, but this will be perpetually free, 6.8. They just reverted back because so many of you agreed that this was not a good decision. For those of you who don't know this, the problem is this tool was free for 7 years or 8 years, and now they said, you know what, actually, we have now millions of customers out there, and we'd now charge them. We'd now like to charge them. Which seemed like a brilliant idea for the MBAs working there, but the developers didn't like it. Okay, so we have this, and there is a Reflektor Pro. Not ReSharper, Reflektor. Oh, I haven't installed it on my machine, so I can't even show it to you. In ReSharper, actually I bought this, but it's a new machine which I just set up a few weeks ago, and I have not installed all my tools. Normally it should show up because I've installed Reflektor, the regular Reflektor. But whatever. So what Reflektor Pro does is it gives you the same capabilities of Reflektor, but inside of Visual Studio, including debugging. So it takes a compiled DLL, decompiles the full DLL, creates matching symbols which point from whatever arbitrary DLL you have into this arbitrarily decompiled source code, and allows you to step debug through it. That's massively powerful. This is a commercial tool. That's the only commercial tool I'm going to show or tell you about during this session. But if you need this, the value is tremendous. And the cost is around 150 euros or something. And the value is massive because you can step debug through whatever code you have in a DLL. Okay, so these are the two options you have currently to debug foreign code. The .NET version of downloading this or the Reflektor Pro version of decompiling this one. Then, then there are also interesting things like sharing code with other developers or sharing at debugging stages with other developers. That's something which Microsoft has put a lot of effort on to make this possible, and I'm going to show you a few things here. First, let's just add our breakpoint to the customer here again. And let's assume that you got a bug report from a client. You're working on this bug report, you're following the repro steps, and you find the root cause or some possible cause of this problem. Unfortunately, it's not your code, it's somebody else's code in your company. So you could just, you know, send them an email, go to your bug tracking system, say reassign to John Doe. Then John would have to do the same steps again. That's the problem. So you'd have, you wouldn't be able to share much information on a technical basis. In Visual Studio, you have a few interesting features. One of them is this pinning of data items. So there's this pinpoint here. I can't zoom because my zoom tool works on control, and as soon as you press control, it gets invisible. But I can pin them, and after pinning, they would just be placed next to your code. Now, at the beginning, at the first glance, this looks like a feature which you'd never need to use. Now, you can also pin more than one. You can pin details. And basically, this could tell you what's currently happening in your code. And you can write a comment to it. You can basically give some hint to your coworker to say, you know what, this should not be John. That's actually somebody else, etc. You just write a comment. And these will be persisted. So I can stop this application. They are gone now because they would otherwise be in the way of my source code. But as soon as I F5 this, I'll get the same data tip again. So if you debug some interesting algorithms, this might be helpful even if you don't have a coworker with whom you want to share data. Yep. Okay, interesting question is, if you're using SVN as a repository, how will they persist in this environment? So by default, they will be persisted in your solution file like a breakpoint. So you can't share them by default, or you don't automatically share them. Let's call it this way. But you can go to debug export data tips, and you can program a macro doing this, of course. And this would export these data tips into an XML file, or some data tips into an XML file. The same is, interestingly enough, now possible with breakpoints. You can label breakpoints. You can give them a name. That's a new feature in 28. And you can export them. And just so you know, these are the... Oops. No, this was too much. These are the international symbols for saving breakpoints. This might be obvious, but this is the international symbol for loading breakpoints from a file. That's a bit non-obvious. I found the save breakpoints pretty quickly, but it took me a while to find out how to reload them. And then you can save your breakpoints or certain selected breakpoints into an XML file again. You could also right-click them and choose Export Selected. And then you can ship them over, put them into SVN or however you want to communicate. You can, of course, program macros. Usually, if you want to use this feature extensively, you write a macro for this, where you could select a few things and hit one button to transfer information. So that's one thing you can do. The next thing is just assume the following. There are problems which we as developers constantly hate. The worst class of problems ever is the following. You do something. Let's say I'll enter some value here and I click on try. And I click on try and the application says okay and everything seems to be working okay. I enter some other data, interact with some other piece of data in your database. It's still okay. You interact with another piece of data and you get an exception, which is okay. Unfortunately, it's a null reference exception. That's not okay. Because a null reference exception is the worst kind of exception because it never happens where the problem is, but it happens somewhere else. That's why it's the worst case of the worst kind of exception. In this case, I've got a method here which is called process customer, And well, for whatever reason, I get in a null reference here. So what do we normally do? Well, we look at the call stack, say, where did this come from? And okay, comes from customer, customer get customer. We are writing the debug output, and then we call process customer. And obviously, I is 42 now, so customer 42 didn't exist. I could now continue in this code, and I could go into get customer with you, and you know, get customer only creates a new customer. So our null reference exception can't really come from here. So the next question is, where does it come from? Of course, here I have simplified this scenario. There are only three lines of code. In reality, this scenario is broad. You're looking at maybe 25, maybe 50,000 lines of code. And somewhere in between, for whatever reason, this object is suddenly set to null for whatever reason you don't know because somebody else did it. So null ref is usually a bad thing. And there is one feature, and that's unfortunately Microsoft made a licensing decision here, which I'm not too happy with. It's called IntelliTrace. And this is a feature which is only available in Ultimate or in the test edition of Visual Studio. So I'm just going to spend only a small amount of time on it because I know that not everybody is using one of those two editions. But I'm just showing you these because this is fantastic. And I hope that enough feedback is generated from Microsoft to include this in the regular edition of Visual Studio. You check it, enable IntelliTrace. There's an option, debug options IntelliTrace. You can then select if you want events only or events and call information. And if you have Ultimate, then you have to look at IntelliTrace. It's fantastic. IntelliTrace is what we always wanted. It's a historical debugger. It's like a black box in an airplane. You can walk back in time to find out how something happened. You can view variables the way they looked before some method calls, etc., etc. Okay, so let's start this. Do the same thing. And 30 doesn't work, 40 doesn't work, 50 works. And you know what? Even if you don't have Ultimate, you know, if you have a bug like this, I'd actually download a trial version of Ultimate. I think there are 60-day trials or whatever to at least get to this problem right now because you can use this to fix problems which you can't fix in any other way. Okay, so we're running 50. Okay, it tells us, yep, it doesn't work. And then I need to show debug windows, IntelliTrace, events. That's the default view of the world of IntelliTrace. That's only the first view. It's interesting. IntelliTrace is such a small window, but the information you see there is big. It's unfortunately not very obviously displayed. Okay, the first view of the world is the events view. You see what the user did. The user clicked try. And the system displayed a message box, the user clicked OK. User clicked try, display message box clicked OK. User clicked try, and, well, something happened. OK, so that's fine. We understand this part. And then you can click here or here and then here and go to, yep, that's a little bug in IntelliTrace. You have to click the line before, and then you can go back to the one you're actually interested in and click on calls view. Yeah, I don't know. It's really... You can see with IntelliTrace that they spent a whole lot of time getting this feature to work and didn't have any time left to make the visualization work, which is a bit of a pain. Okay, but now we are in this view. We can go to calls view. And let me just move to some place where we can actually see something. And okay, this looks like a call stack, but it is not a call stack. It is a historical view of many, many call stacks. Behind each line here, you get a full call stack. It tells you that, you know, the user clicked button try for IntelliTrace. And then the system called get customer with I equals 0. And then the system called customer with get I equals 1. And you see all the historic calls. So I can scroll down to the very end. And then I can see, okay, at the end, I'm currently in this one, in this branch. It's I equals 42, et cetera, et cetera. Before this, it was called with I equals 41. So let's look at this version. Let's look at, actually, I want to look at this one. Yep. So that's, we are going back in time now. We are two loops before the one we are currently in, or one loop before the one we are currently in. So the value I is 41. You see all the locals, the way they looked like when this happened. And I click the next line, okay, and I got a customer. Yep, and there's a customer, and you get all the variables here. And then we process the customer, everything went okay. The loop continued. I was 42 now. Get customer was executed. Yep, I got a customer. Next line, I lost my customer, but I lost it in write debug output. Of course, that's a generated thing here, and I made this for the demo, but you can imagine you lost it somewhere else. Now you can go back in time and can see exactly how long did you have it. If we go into write debug output, just to explain this, somebody made this into a ref parameter. That's just, you know, I've taken these things from real systems. It wasn't as easy as I'm presenting this here, of course, but there was a ref parameter where there shouldn't have been one. This was a long method, and somebody forgot that, you know, this is a ref parameter and did something like this. They just set it to null because they didn't need it in this method anymore. And nobody realized this was an edge case. This was in an exception handler or something. You know, the exception triggered, user set it to null, forgot that it was a ref parameter, and there you go. And IntelliTrace helps you to find these things because you can step through and go back in time. Now, this feature alone is nice as it is. The next thing is you can take these IntelliTraces and, or this the IntelliTrace tool, and run it outside of. Yes, I really want to delete this. No, I need permission. I am administrator. So let's try if I can close this one. No, I still can't. Now, what do we do if this happens? There is fortunately a tool, and given that this is a debugging session, it's absolutely okay that things like these happen. Let's just start this one. We're running this as an administrator. You have to run this tool as an administrator. There's a tool called handle.exe. And you can download this from TechNet, from Microsoft. It used to be SysInternal, now it's Microsoft. This is one of the first things I download on my machine. I copy directly in the Windows directory so that I have this no matter what. And I want to see the handles for this log.itrace. And no matching handles are found. This is bad because this means nobody is currently holding the handle, which makes it more interesting why I can't delete this. Oh, now I can delete this. Somebody held the handle, quite likely an antivirus tool. But normally, if you run handle.exe on a file name, it will list you who is currently blocking this file. Or unlocker, there are a number of tools in this whole package, that's true. But I'm favorite, you know, the thing is you get used to something and then you continue using this one. Okay, but now we have IntelliTrace, and that's a batch file now, and that's a collection plan. Collection plan defines how to collect information, and you can imagine that I'm now a tester. I'm not a developer, I'm a tester. Unfortunately, licensing currently doesn't allow you to ship this to your end customer, but you can run this on a tester machine when they testers normally use, say, Visual Studio Test Edition. Okay, so now your tester is doing this. Outside of Visual Studio, I've closed Visual Studio, there's no studio. 40, 50. Okay, your tester gets this exception. Your tester would normally go ahead and file a bug report detailing the steps. I entered 30, I entered 40, I entered 50, and then it did this, and continue and close this. If you run IntelliTrace, you get an iTrace file instead. If you run TFS, you can directly put this into TFS with your test results, and the developer can right-click it and or can simply double-click it, open it in Visual Studio, and follow the exact steps which caused this problem. You see your threads. I click on, it's still loading. And let's see how long the loading takes. And you can then click on one thread and you get the same IntelliTrace information we had before. You have the same events. You can extend those events so that you know you can put in individual events. But we see the same thing. User clicked OK, clicked try trace, and we could follow exactly the same steps through our application. That's what I'm saying. That's why I said it's pretty magic. Okay, so that's IntelliTrace. And let's go back to our real Visual Studio again. IntelliTrace would be fantastic if it would be part of every edition of Visual Studio. I totally realize this. And now we're stepping back to an area where we have features which are available for all kinds of versions of Visual Studio. And one of them is, it's not as magic as IntelliTrace, but close enough. What I'm showing you now works with every edition of Visual Studio. I don't know if it works with the Express, with every commercial edition of Visual Studio. And let's just assume that you have the following situation. Let's just assume that, well, actually, I need the binary for this one, so I don't need this one. Let's just go into the binary folder. Let's just assume that the following is happening. Your customer runs the application and clicks a button. And it gives you the very detailed answer that it could not do its work. How do we normally solve this problem? You know, I've done a lot of sessions on WinDebug. I love WinDebug. WinDebug is my debugger of choice. The only problem is that WinDebug is not the debugger of anybody else's choice because it's extremely complicated. And it's a console debugger. You interact with commands like, you know, switch to thread 3 or give me the call stack of thread number 3 would be tilde 3e CLR stack. Very obvious commands like these. I like this. I don't know why. Maybe something was wrongly wired. Or most people don't like this. I don't know why. It's perfect. And it has 200 commands, and most of them are two-letter commands and a sign and two letters or something like this. So it's fantastic. And it has been designed for people who really know this by heart so that they can be very quick. That's the thing. It's tilde... number enter is a lot quicker than going to mouse, moving around, clicking it, opening the thread window, etc. But only if you really do this on a day-by-day basis. Okay, so WinDebug had one advantage. Why is WinDebug the debugger of choice? Because it allows you to do crash dump debugging of .NET applications. And this was possible since version 1 of the .NET framework. For more than 10 years, you could totally look into .NET crash dumps, but only if you knew how WinDebug worked. And with Visual Studio 2010, finally, this feature, the crash dump debugging, goes into Visual Studio itself. Problem is the following. This is a .NET 4 feature. It's a runtime feature of .NET 4, so you need to write a .NET 4 application, run it inside of .NET 4. And then you can create a crash dump of your application, just the same way you would always create a crash dump. Maybe by telling your user to start Task Manager, going to your application and clicking on create dump file. That's a feature, part of Task Manager since Windows 7, Windows Vista actually. Or you could directly build this in your application. I've built it in the application. Whenever an unhandled, unexpected exception happens, I'm creating a dump file here. So I can just ask my user to send me this file. And in my case, this file is in C dumps. And there is one auto dump direct, and it's of today, yep. Right-click it, open with Visual Studio. And these dumps are pretty big. I mean, we have to be serious about this. This dump contains everything your application sees while this dump has been created. It is a complete memory snapshot of the application. So, of course, it's as big as the application's memory was. And so it's big. This one is 120 megabytes in size. They are compressible. You can compress this down to 20 megs or something like this, and then your client could upload it. But you can now open this in Visual Studio. You can then click on Debug with Mixed, and you'll get source-level information about how your application looked like when you have written this dump file. Now, writing the dump file is one single API call. You call minidump write dump. You can download this sample, of course. That's all part of the sample. You pass in a PID and a file name, and it will create a dump of this PID. If the process is your own process, or if it's running under your own user, you don't need to have administrative privileges for this. It just works. That's a standard feature of Windows. And then you can go back in the call stack. And, of course, at the beginning, you see some weird frames. So you have to get used to this. You see some weird frames like these. If you are a WinDebug user, you see these all the time. Actually, I'm not even seeing them. I'm actually automatically filtering them. My brain is filtering those things from me. As I told you, there's some wiring problem, obviously. Okay, and then you see, you know, we called create mini dump, and you know there's a method called not so helpful error, and we'll just click ourselves somewhere here. And what I did here is just I have a method which calls doWork, and doWork throws an exception. And in the exception handler, I have code which creates this dump file. What does this mean? It means I can now examine my application. I can look at things like, well, I can, of course, look at the exception and details for the exception. So details for the exception would be could not find part of the path, see this file does not exist because it doesn't exist. And which is true, so the application is at least not lying. More often than not, you get error messages which are actually wrong. And that's also where a dump file helps you, because no matter what error message you have written in your code, if you have the dump file, you have the reality. A dump never lies. So, and you can examine all your objects. So you can examine this pointer of your form, and you can see all the the items on your form. You can click your way through this. You see all the threads, everything. It's just in the instance, as it looked at the instance when you took this snapshot. And that's massive, and that's part of all the commercial editions of Visual Studio. And a lot of our clients actually prepare their applications today so that they automatically take these dump files when an unexpected exception happens. There are two kinds of dump files. There are the type 6 dump files. This was the one you've seen right now. Let me just go back to mini dump write dump. Oh, no, it's wrong one. Mini dump write dump. And here you can see there are two dump types. There's a dump type 0 and dump type 6. 6 means all the information. 0 means only the absolute bare minimum. A dump type 0 dump, is about 120 kilobytes, not 120 megabytes. So the difference is massive. But you only see the current stack frame. You get information about the exception, information about all the threads in all the call stacks in all threads at this point in time. But you can't look at the values of all your objects. Of course, this wouldn't fit into 100 kilobytes in size. Okay, but for me, creating a dump file, since I've started creating dump files, I hardly write log files because they are so more expressive. Yes, please.
It's also possible to include some of the IntelliTrace data in
a mini dump. That's a good question. Is it possible to include the IntelliTrace output? And the answer is unfortunately not. IntelliTrace is currently only licensed for use by a user of Visual Studio, not by your end customer. That's the actual problem. That it's a licensing thing more than anything else. So if you buy your customer a version of Visual Studio, or if you get your customer to download the test edition of Visual Studio, I'm not even mentioning this at a Microsoft event, of course, then you can download the 60-day trial, or you can buy them one edition, which would be the right thing to do, and then they could run IntelliTrace. But it's only licensed for users of Studio. Are there plans to allow it? That's the thing. That's the reason why I'm mentioning this all the time. Whenever I do this session, I mention that I would hope that they allow this, because I hope that you go to your local Microsoft contacts and tell them that it would be great if they would allow this, because then the feedback would over time trickle back to the product teams that everybody is fed up by this decision that it's not part of the product. Yeah. I know, but they say exactly for the logging, the feature is so powerful. The interesting thing is there is a competing product called App Insight Black Box, and this is a product which has a six-figure licensing sum, at least for smaller deployments. There's a whole lot of value in this tool. So I can unfortunately even understand this, of course, a bit. Okay, so what else do we have? We have, well, a few more tools which I tend to use and without which I can hardly imagine debugging code. Now, there is one which is called DebugView. Some of you might know this. DebugView is a sysinternals tool. You can download it from TechNet, and it shows you all the debug.writeline and trace.writeline statements which are currently happening in your application without having to attach Visual Studio. You can just run this next to your app. I talked about Reflector Pro. That's for decompiling. Beartail. And all of those are available for free, at least in a limited edition for free. Beartail is, if you are a Unix user, you know what tail does. Tail-f follows a file. So if you write log files, you can follow them, and Beartail does the same thing. You configure it, it's multi-tabbed, you can have filters and highlights and alerts, and then it can follow multiple log files, and it will just scroll on so that you can see what's happening in your different log files. That's, for me, Beartail is an essential. LinkPad is something I use to quickly execute code. In LinkPad, you can call .dump on any variable, and you get a graphical representation of what you are currently looking at. So it's not just for link, but for any kind of C# statement. And then I often use attach to process. That's one of my favorite features in general. For whatever reason, I don't use F5 in real programming very often when I'm creating web applications, for example. Because I like to run my web applications not in Cassini, but in IIS. And I don't hit F5 because the recompilation cycle takes way longer than it would need to. So what I usually do is I use debug attached to process. And then you can attach yourself to a running process, be it a service or be it whatever it is. So you could attach to Internet Explorer or to W3WP, which would be IIS, to debug your applications. And you'll find a macro for this on my weblog as well, which you can just take into your studio, put it behind a button click so that you can do single button click attach to IIS, to attach to Firefox, attach to IE. By the way, there's one more thing. If you, let's say you're writing JavaScript code, and that's even possible if your application hosts the Internet Explorer control, the web browser control, inside of your application, and you're running JavaScript inside of this application, and you'd like to debug this JavaScript. Usually, well, you know, you can't F5 this in Visual Studio. What you can do is you can attach to your own application, which runs the web browser control, which runs JavaScript. But what you have to do is you have to manually, and that's why I mentioned this, you have to manually go to the whole dialogue is incorrectly layouted, unfortunately. It says attach to, and then it says automatic native. This attach to actually means this one. Automatic native is independent, because that's just the type of debugging you want to do. You can click on select here to select the type of debugging. And auto works for everything apart from JavaScript debugging in foreign processes. But you can debug these code types script. And then if your application runs with the web browser control, you can debug JavaScript inside of this application. And of course, you could directly attach to IE as well and enable script, and you do script debugging. Same is true for Silverlight debugging. If you run Silverlight in IE and don't want to F5 this because you want to detach and reattach, you can also just use Silverlight and attach yourself to IE. You'll be able to debug Silverlight in this foreign process. That's something I use quite often, and the attach to process macro helps you a bit with this. Okay, so what I'll do now is I'll move back so you can get the address in which you'll get the downloads for the macro and for the sample application if you're interested in this one. Well, we've reached the end of this session. I hope that I've helped you, and I hope that I could convey a few of my debugging points. I hope that you've enjoyed it. Well, that's number one. I hope that you think that it was a good use of your time. For me, debugging is something I do way too often. I think, well, I do it very often, not way too often. But in general, knowing your debugger is essential, because you debug a line of code 5 times even though you write it only once. And with this, I'd like to thank you very much for being here, and hope to see you again next year at this event. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.